working with people interactively. You're coaching them, having a great counseling session. And then the moment comes after the second session, third session, and you're well into the fourth session. And you ask your counselee, I hear you saying that you and your spouse aren't getting along? And she retorts, she responds immediately saying, that's not what I said. I said we were working on our problems. Indignant. And as the counselor, you are then sitting there a bit chagrined, but taking it all in and trying to make sense of what she is saying about she and her husband and the process that they're going through in resolving their issues. Hearing, listening, encoding, where we give input, decoding, where we process input. It's exactly what psychology helps us to understand as we look at sense perception. The last video we talked about sensing and perceiving. This now follows up the sensory experience as we look at interactivity, how we listen, how we connect. Especially as we think we have heard things right, if we have seen things correctly, but we don't. And vice versa. Conversely, when it comes from the counselee and she thinks or he thinks, I thought you said this, counselor, pastor. Weren't you trying to help me with my disdain about me or my disdain about my spouse, and you're saying, no, that's not what I was trying to say at all. Not only misperception, but also trying to understand with perception. Well, it takes us into the perceptual system. The perceptual system. And the perceptual system takes us into sensory interaction. And sensory interaction is that working together of different senses to create experiences. Working together of different senses to create experience. Where my eyes and my ears and my other senses together, taste, touch, are trying to make sense of what is happening in front of me and then to draw some conclusions, but often we draw false assumptions. The goal, of course, with the sensory perception is that we use our senses to better understand the person, to hear correctly, to see correctly, the emotion on the person's face, and of course, when we sense that a person may be sad, maybe they're really mad. Or if a person is jovial, maybe they're really angry. They're just putting on a face, a mask. Our perceptions do need to be as accurate as possible as we help the best way we can as listeners, as counselors, as pastors. And that working together of different senses to create an experience, this is the framework, context that we always want to keep psychology in, how we help people. And the perpetual system takes us from sensory interaction then into what we call the McGurk effect. The McGurk effect. As you may recall, I just said that sometimes we don't get it right, and we need to listen more carefully. Perception can be quite a deception. See, the McGurk effect is an error in sound perception that occurs when there is a mismatch between senses of hearing and seeing. An error in sound perception that occurs when there is a mismatch between the senses of hearing and seeing. And so as what we often then think we are understanding the person is saying, it's often not. For example, when I was in my high school choir and Mr. Scott was teaching us how to do vocal inflection and projection and also diction and being mindful of how we enunciate using our tongues and teeth and lips and mouth, and just as I'm always conscious now of how I come across here in the video. Always trying to articulate very well. However, when we were in our rehearsal practice sessions in class with Mr. Scott before a big concert, he would say, "Now, if you run stuck, if you don't remember some of the verses or parts of the verses as we are in concert, one of the techniques is to make the audience think that you know the words to the song that we are singing all together is this. Use the word watermelon. Why? Because using the word watermelon, 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 if for some reason, he would say to us as high schoolers, you just blank out, it isn't there. Just mouth the words watermelon, 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 again, using the diction and the form of your mouth, and also how you project watermelon, watermelon, watermelon. Now, as a speaker, as a pastor who preaches, or if you're in front delivering a special speech, you can't get away with that. However, in a group, of course, you are then amongst other singers, you are then following along with the orchestra or the band that's playing the tune, and you are then, or the track, and it's playing the tune of the song you are performing. And the audience is taking it all in. And you get stuck, and Mr. Scott said, watermelon, watermelon. Such is the McGurk effect. The McGurk effect also describes, too, when our lips, again, with the watermelon, and here's the point, our lips move and we are saying watermelon, but the people think what they're seeing and perceiving is, are the actual songs of the hymn or the contemporary hymn that you are singing in the concert. Now we have a label for it. Now we understand it. Oh, that's the McGurk effect. Of course. And also what we then think a person may be mumbling or saying in counseling sessions, but they really aren't. That's why the McGurk effect is that error in sound perception that occurs when there is a mismatch between what we see and hear. And so the McGurk effect, of course, just as a reminder, these videos are overviews. We're not going to get into all the details in these videos, but the overview, the highlights, the brushstrokes. That's what we're getting into with this chapter today, this topic, as part of your process for the course in psychology. The perceptual system also talks about selective attention, which is the ability to focus on some sensory inputs while tuning out others. Let's say, for example, your spouse, if it's your wife, husband, or wife, if it's your husband, and you're trying to tell him or you're trying to tell her all about the story, about what happened today. And your spouse has something else on her mind or his mind. They're thinking about work. They're thinking about The kids are thinking about what they're going to eat for dinner. Spaghetti or pizza? And you're trying to tell the story, and it's you're going to detail and expression and passion. And they, by about 10 minutes into the story, you notice there's something not going on to, not you're not connecting. And say, honey, you know what I mean? And they kind of break out, what? Huh? Or they may be listening to you and they're tracking and they're hearing the content and chunks of the content about what happened with her and with him at the workplace and what happened as you were driving down the road and swerving to miss that deer. But they don't hear everything. Selective attention. You know what it's like. Yeah, honey, sure, I hear you. And you didn't. We always joke about selective hearing. I'm not listening. Okay. Yeah. We are selective in how we sometimes listen. The same is true for this effect in the perpetual system. We choose, we have the ability to choose to select and focus on some sensory inputs while tuning out others. And sometimes it happens in our marriages or in our interaction with our colleagues at the church or the ministry or the organization we work for or the corporate place we work for, if you're working in the corporate world, and they really don't care to listen to you. Or maybe they're just feeling like, I'll listen to you, but only just so much, because I am selecting to hear some of it just so I know enough to say, okay, and make sure you know I'm listening. Or, of course, other situations where you're in a crowded room and you are selecting what you need to hear and what you don't want to hear. The brain has the ability to compartmentalize, we say, to sort that out. And so selective attention is that terminology. And from selective attention, we go to synesthesia. Synesthesia is what we call an experience in which one sensation creates experiences in another. So for example, the one sensation, you may smell that shift in the wind out in the farmer's field. And they have a lot of cow pies, we say, a lot of cow dung. And at first, when you walked into that beautiful farmland, it smelled great. It was fresh smells of the farm. But then the wind shifts, and the dung smell comes through, and ooh, is it pungent. Almost to the point, and almost similar to my experience, I was in fourth grade. My dad and I, we went to Iowa here in the United States, a lot of farms, pig farms, and we visited this pig farm. And Farmer Doug, he brought us to the pigs, and they were in mass. And I was thinking, ooh, I see, with the one sensation, I see all these pigs. They're very interesting. They're cute. And also, I was brought to the fence where they were all, you know, all jammed in together. And then I noticed that the shift in the wind and the smell, whoo, it was pungent. It was nauseating. Well, same thing in the whole farm field example. The wind shifts, I smell one thing, but then the one sensation, but it brings on another sensation in my olfactories. And I get a little nauseated with what I'm smelling at the moment. Well, that's what synesthesia is trying to explain. We have one experience that then creates another. In more detail in your book. So from the synesthesia, that brings us into the whole discussion of sensory adaptation. So you see, sensory adaptation is a decreased sensitivity to a stimulus after prolonged and constant exposure. So with sensory adaptation, in other words, we then, of course, just as the definition is saying, we our sensitivity to a particular stimulus, let's go back to the dung example. We then, that prolonged sensitivity then goes down when we then are exposed to it for a long time. So if I'm in that farmer's field and I'm smelling the dung smell, and at first, ooh, it's nauseating. But then my sensory adaptation, that is, with my senses of smell and also other senses that go with it, and taste, if you will, kind of goes in there too. You can almost taste the smell. It then adapts. We then get used to it, we say. And that's all this is saying as far as adaptation. Adaptation. And so from sensory adaptation, we then go to perceptual constancy. The ability to perceive a stimulus as constant despite changes in sensation. I'll say it again. The ability to perceive a stimulus as constant despite changes in sensation. So, for example, I have my mug of coffee. At first, ooh, it's hot, but it tastes good. And I have a prolonged sensitivity to, ooh, the hotness of the liquid. But then I get used to it. And then what happens is I then adapt, and yet the experience is constant. It doesn't change. But my senses adapt to the temperature and the experience of taste and tasting the act thereof of the liquid. So that's where these terms come into play about adaptation, senses, and decreased sensitivity. Well, then there's this other adaptation that happens in our senses as far as what we listen to and don't listen to. Kind of going back to the McGurk effect is how it's called the cocktail party phenomenon. And the cocktail party phenomenon is this: via or by way of selective attention, we simultaneously do a lot of unconscious monitoring of the world around us. Now, in the next video, we're going to talk about consciousness, the subconscious, the conscious, and so forth. But here, we're only going to touch on it just a little. The cocktail party phenomenon is where we have selective attention. And as we are in a crowded room, at a party, for example, or maybe a socially distanced room at this point, of course, with our masks on, that's another discussion about different sensitivities and interactivity. But we simultaneously do a lot of unconscious monitoring of the world around us. So, for example, you may be in that crowded room where there are many other groups of people around you, and you're with your little circle of two or three people, and you're talking and talking about the weather and talking about your kids and talking about what you hope to do with CLI as far as your bachelor's degree and going on for the master's degree. And then at the end of the interaction and at the end of the party, you pull your friend aside and say, "What was going on with Tom and Jack and Sue in that group that was on the other side of the room? Man, boy, they were laughing, but also then it was in hush hush tones and it was they were looking around and all of a sudden paranoia came into me and I didn't know what to do." In other words, the fear of it. What was going on? "Tim, what was going on?" And he says to you, I don't know. I heard it too. I was curious. I noticed the periphery of my eye of what was happening there. The cocktail party effect is that we take in that stimuli as we are also engaged in the stimuli that's right in front of us. But our brains are able to then take in other stimuli as it's coming from another part of the room around us. Yet we don't necessarily hear everything or process everything or understand everything. Going back to the Gestalt theory, we then also have a form of this. So there is a form of the group that we catch in periphery of our eye that in terms of mood, also tenor, also tone, also volume, also interactivity, and we pick it all up. And then it raises questions about intent, motive, mood, attitude. Interesting how the biology of psychology plays into the cognitive part of psychology, the behavioral part of psychology, which we're now easing into now as we look at adaptation and stimulus and also sensitivity, the perpetual system. So the cocktail party effect, that is, in fact, a fascinating effect, or affect effect. Well, that takes us then also into illusions. Illusions. Illusions are, well, common. They are called the perceptual processes that normally help us correctly perceive the world around us are fooled by a particular situation so that we see something that does not exist or that is incorrect. I'll repeat it so we understand it. The perceptual processes that normally help us correctly perceive the world around us are fooled by a particular situation so that we see something that does not exist or that is incorrect. Much like the whole work of Houdini back in the early 20th century or late 19th century in the 20th century. Houdini was the master of illusion. He could make his escapes look impossible, but there's an illusion going on there. Also, with the whole thing of sawing the girl in half on stage, it's an illusion. Well, there are other illusions that psychologists also observe. The first one is the Mueller-Lyer illusion, pictured here. The line segment in the bottom arrow looks longer to us than the one on the top. However, they are both the same length. Take a moment and look at these lines. You have the lines in red on the right, lines also on the left, and they seem to be having one line longer than the other. But the illusion is that they are not, there isn't one longer than the other. It's actually two lines that are the same length, but made to look longer than the other. Well, there's also something called the moon illusion. Now, the moon illusion is also attributed to what airline pilots also have in terms of the effect that they experience. I'll explain that here in a minute. But the moon illusion is this. The moon is perceived to be about 50% larger when it is near the horizon than when it is seen overhead. In both cases, the moon is the same size and casts the same size retinal image, which is pretty straightforward. It's pretty straightforward. So we look at the moon, and we perceive it 50% larger when it's near the horizon than when it seems overhead. But it's the same size when it comes to the retinal image. So illusions, perceptual processes that normally help us correctly perceive the world around us, are fooled by a particular situation so we see something that does not exist or that is incorrect. Which takes us into the next term called embodiment. Embodiment. Now, embodiment is where we build into the link and link the environment with our cognition. In other words, what we see around us, we build it into our brains, our framework in our minds around us. So if we are in that farmer's field, our whole brain then brings that farmer's field into the whole context of our experience. And the world around us becomes part of our brain. This is a great cartoon. You probably have read the byline here already. Good news, the doctor says. The test results show it's a metaphor. And you see the knife in the gentleman's back, and he's trying to get some answers. Embodiment says, wait a minute, the knife, and the whole joke here, of course, not that having a knife in your back is good, it's disturbing. But of course, maybe it's an illusion. Maybe it's a fake knife and the fake stabbing. And of course, magicians have used that trick for decades. That knife is in the back. It seems like it's in the back, but it's not in the back. It's an illusion. However, the embodiment term says, no, we build what we see right in front of us into in our environment, into our thinking. And the world around us becomes part of our brain and what we see and perceive and also then do and be. Well, of course, the joke here is that it's a metaphor. Well, let's come back to the whole moon illusion, just to wrap it up here for today. These are two pictures of two different cockpits, rather, in an airplane. These are commercial airlines. The image on the left is what the book tells us, and you read the whole story in there, in your textbook, is the initial design of an airplane cockpit. A lot of dials, a lot of buttons, and of course you have the controls and so on. That was the first design. That was there for quite a while. However, as researchers got to know better and better what the moon illusion was like for an airline pilot, because as the airline pilot flies in and sees the lights on in the city and also along the runway, they seem larger than life, and they have an illusion that they're closer than what they really are, and so on. So you see then the new design of the airplane cockpit on the right, taking into all the findings and research results, they then redesign the cockpit to be more friendly to the human being, so that as the moon illusion, as the pilot, for example, will look out the window and try to ascertain what is really going on with the clouds, and also maybe there's fog, and of course the lights coming off in the distance with the city they're about to land in. The instruments now better help that pilot, he or she, to better understand what's happening on the runway and to make a safe landing, minimizing accidents. Well, sense perception, many fascinating concepts and also terms to help us understand better our experience as human beings, but also to help us understand the experience of those that we minister to as they see the world around them. It's pretty straightforward here. For example, as you look at how a person then perceives and takes in with their senses the abuse, the expressions of love from their spouse or significant other, and their problems, they come to you as God's representative. As you come to them as God's representative, as an ambassador of the gospel, as a listener, there to help. We now understand, with the help of psychology, which comes right out of Scripture, why and how a person experiences what she experiences or what he experiences, is able to better process, thanks to Carl Rogers, Carl Jung, and also our other researchers, which we looked at in our second video, as far as the history of psychology and the research that those pioneers did, we now better understand how it all comes together to better help and direct a person to God and to the processes God's given them, and where the Holy Spirit begins to do the healing process one step at a time. It's been good to look at the perpetual system with you, and now we go into the states of consciousness next.